Comencem, doncs. Bon dia. Dir només que faré la presentació en anglès perquè així la doctora Kishbuk la pugui entendre i tota l'exposició serà en anglès, tot i que la Carme ja farà alguna explicació abans de començar la seva presentació. Good morning. My name is Fina Patiño and I will be introducing this morning presentation. First of all, I want to thank you for being here today. And I also want really to thank Doctora Dolors Jubinyà, the coordinator of the Master Degree in Health Promotion at the University of Girona, for bringing to our institution this opportunity. The Faculty of Nursing is very pleased to welcome Professora Ilona Kishbuk, PhD, a very special guest from Switzerland. Doctora Kishbuk is the director of the Global Health Program at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies of Geneva. And also, she currently serves on a panel to assess the World Health Organization. On the other hand, we have the chance to have here Doctora Carme Cabezas, General Subdirector of the Health Promotion at the Department de la Generalitat de Catalunya, who will introduce us the Interdepartmental Plan for Public Health of Catalonia, Strategies and Program, PINSAP, that allow the rationalization of previous initiative and coordinated the capitalization of health contents in governmental actions. Today, both will be sharing with us their expert opinion on health in all policies. Recognized through the world for her contribution to the health promotion and global health, Dr. Kishbuk has a distinguished career and published widely on this topic. She worked hardly as a member of several advisory boards, WHO, University of Yale, etc., and also has contributed to health policy innovations at the national and international level to promote health and improve the equity in health. I want to remark that she was a member of the core group that developed the first European health policy based on the health targets at the WHO Regional Office for Europe, which was adopted by the member states in 1984. Also, she was one of the responsible for the Ottawa Charter for health promotion in 1986 and has been involved in the formation of Bangkok Charter for health promotion in a globalized world in 2005. After the 8th Global Conference on Health Promotion, Helsinki 2013, under the World Health Organization and with the aim to support the implementation of the Health 2020 framework in WHO European region, she wrote the report Implementing a Health 2020 Vision, Governance for Health in the 21st Century, which provides a value-based action-oriented policy adaptable to different realities and addressed to the ministries of health, but also to policymakers and stakeholders through the society, who can contribute to improve leadership and participatory governance to achieve human health and well-being. Of course, I can be a lot of time speaking about the whole contribution that Dr. Kishbuk has done to the health promotion policies, but it's not possible. It's not the time now. Therefore, I cannot forget to mention her contribution as a leader in developing the concept of health literacy. Her significantly role in the field of women's health and empowerment. Also, her developed programs such as Healthy Cities, Health Promoting Schools, and Healthy Workplaces. Due to her long experience and curricula hope, she will give us some highlights to follow, and is for that I ask you your full attention sorry, and help me in welcoming her to the stage. Dr. Kitchbook, when you want,
thank
please.
You very much. Shall we try and get this?
Do you want to sit here?
I'll stand.
Okay.
Does this work?
Yes.
Why didn't I come to you? So good afternoon, and thank you very much, Dean, for your very kind introduction. That's what happens when you get old, you know, your CV gets longer and longer. Thank you for having me here in Girona, and already yesterday I was able to explore a bit of this beautiful city, and I was sort of thinking everyone that lives here must be incredibly healthy. I heard from you it's not quite the case, so a lot still remains to be done. The second problem I had when I was invited was to say, what shall I actually talk about? Because plan that has been developed in Catalonia for health and more policies is one of the most advanced in the European region. And therefore, and I said it earlier in the smaller meeting, you know, we in English one says bringing colds to Newcastle, sort of, you know, what should I tell you about things that you are doing so well already? And there's nothing more boring, I think, than a speaker who tells you everything you already know. So I don't know if what I put together is going to be helpful. At least I did put some thought into it, and I tried to, and I'm concerned, particularly as you will see, with the political dimension of health and all policies. One of my concerns has been also, I must say, at the Helsinki conference on health and all policies, that health and all policies is seen as a technical endeavor. And but once you've reached a certain level of technical excellence in all this, it actually becomes very clear, and particularly in situations of either political or economic crises, how political health and all policies actually is. And that's basically what I am focusing on. Obviously, a starting point always is our understanding of health, and some of you might be familiar with this Oslo Lancet report from 2014. If you're not, I would recommend it very much to you, because it deals with the political determinants of health. And the Lancet report has selected seven areas that one needs to look at from a global health perspective, but since the global and the local are very, very interrelated nowadays, it highlights areas that we need to be very aware of if we want to do health and law policies. Migration is one such area, trade is one such area, taxation is one such area, and others. And you can see clearly here, they say health is a precondition, an outcome, and an indicator of a sustainable society, should be adopted as a universal value. So already any political discussion is based on values and a shared social goal and political objective. So actually in those four lines you have a lot of the kind of things that we need to consider, and particularly the notion of a political objective. And of course, here in Catalonia, you have gone several steps in that direction in that your proposals have been adopted by all political parties, which is not something one can say for a number of other countries, and therefore you've created a very good base to actually be able to move forward. I've indicated there is this tension, not always support from both sides, tension between the technical and the political. And my feeling is sometimes in the health promotion community, there is not enough awareness of how political health has actually become. We are in a period where health is incredibly political, and because it's relevant to the economy, obviously, and we've done a lot of these studies trying to argue from our side why health is important for the economy. But it's also always very, very critical in terms of political ideology and legitimacy of the state, absolutely, and to the expectations of citizens. So it's within a really political set of dynamics that we really need to be much, much more aware of. And if you think of the discussions, to take an extreme example, around Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act in the United States, it's really, it shows how political and how much ideology is part of debating health. So it's very political, but it's also incredibly symbolic. If you think of the discussions right now in relation to the National Health Service in the United Kingdom, a real debate, our National Health Service, this stands for what the United Kingdom, in this case then particularly England, stands for. It's all about how do we define the common good? How do we define such responsibilities? And of course, in the whole discussion around austerity also, health has come into play as a very, very key factor. So we've got to be very aware that the health discussion today is about the role of the state, it's about the role of the market, and it's about the role of individuals. And different actors obviously define them very, very differently. And if you do health and health policies, that's where you will be embroiled in that kind of debate. And that's why, on the one hand, and I'll come back to that, yes, of course, we need to involve many stakeholders. But to presuppose that all these stakeholders want health, forget it. And the fact is, we also have to learn in a whole number of ways to deal with conflict in this whole area. Partly health promotion has been very successful in dealing with that in tobacco. But I feel sometimes we don't use enough of that tobacco experience for some of the other areas that we're involved in. Actually, we partly forget it. And actually, here we have one of the other problems I believe we've developed in health promotion. We are not a unified community. We're a tobacco community, we're an AIDS community, now we're a sugar community. But to really come together as one health promotion community and learn from each other, particularly for those political fights, I think is one of the challenges that very, very seriously has to be addressed. Because also a lot of the community work we need in health promotion has been done, for example, in HIV/AIDS. But then, we have the NCD, the non-communicable disease community over here, and then, there's a fight between the NCD community and the health promotion community, whether one should take a vertical or horizontal approach. And then you have the infectious community over here, even though one of the areas, and I'll show you this in a minute, that has pioneered health in all policies long before we ever spoke about it, has been the infectious disease community. So I think there's some catching up we all have to do, as we move forward. And that was one of the weaknesses of the Helsinki meeting, that it did not really also bring these communities together. WHO, of course, raises the warning voice regularly, and this is Dr. Margaret Chan, the Director General, who says very clearly that the challenges facing public health are very numerous, but they're also much too complex for, as she said, a business as usual approach. And so, of course, trying to implement health and all policies in a variety of ways, applying new kinds of governance, is one of the ways one needs to do that. And if you look at the challenges that we actually face right now, you see very clearly how political each and every one of these challenges are. I mean, in the health field, we'll then, you know, use our alphabet soup and talk about social determinants of health, universal health coverage, antimicrobial resistance, the non-communicable diseases, and, you know, health security and the international health regulations. And Spain was, of course, also involved in all the discussions and the fears around Ebola when you had the cases. But you can see that each of these things that we discuss as a health challenge or a health policy challenge, you can look at from a different dimension. You can sort of look at it as the larger issue it reflects, like inequality, inequity, globalization of lifestyles, etc. Or you can look at it partly through the eyes of, you know, the political and the value challenges that come. You know, if you talk about inequity, you're obviously talking about social justice and social protection. You know, a big issue in relation to the social state. If you're talking universal access, you're talking new mechanisms of financing, and the question is again partly redistribution or how do you approach that. If you're talking the environment, you're talking, you know, implementing large international agreements, you know, Kyoto protocols and things like that, 2 degrees warming, like here. Globalization of lifestyles, enormous. This is about the market. This is about the global market. And this is no longer about, you know, companies. We like to think of, you know, Coca-Cola or Nestle or something. But these are enormous growth areas in the global market. And therefore, they have become very interesting for private equity firms. And actually, both Burger King and Anheuser-Busch, plus, you know, the largest beer company in the world, now belong to a private equity company. And guess where that private equity company is? Does anyone know? I'm going to take off my jacket if I'm otherwise gentlemen will miss it. But that's what expresses that private equity company is called G3 and it's Brazilian. So also, this is no longer an issue of the global north and the global south. Money is made everywhere. And it's a very, very interesting case study of how, you know, a private equity company actually gets rich through the globalization of lifestyles and through unhealthy products. Fascinating case study. And then, of course, the political challenge of health security in relation to outbreaks and other things. And here you see health in all policies at work. Only we don't always necessarily look at it that way. You see the United States in the Security Council, the UN Security Council, proclaiming Ebola a threat to international peace and security. You have the negotiations of the Eurogroup around austerity and the Greek agreements or not. You have President Obama speaking on the Affordable Care Act and also personally involved as president in antimicrobial resistance and in the fight against Ebola. So you see, you know, it's really moved up the political totem pole. You see Japan International Tobacco filing in the London High Court against plain packaging, so taking it into the justice system, and I'll come back to that. You have the fight around the soda tax, and you have popular votes on whether to introduce new forms of taxation or not. So, you know, I'm always surprised in the health promotion area, if you sometimes talk with people, they say, we don't have enough examples about health and law policies. Health and law policies is everywhere. It's just not necessarily the health and law policies we would like to see. And therefore the question is, you know, how do we get our notion of health and law policies into some of these negotiations? But also the other way around, when we present health and law policies, how do we recognize that actually, in many cases, policymakers are taking health very seriously for the reasons I told you earlier, and because they have to be seen by their electorate also to be concerned about their health. And then suddenly we have a new partner in health and law policies, and here in Ebola, as you at least know from the newspapers, the big challenge was how do the health people work with the security people, with the army, and the other way around. So you see the chiefs of staff looking at this little man from the Centers for Disease Control and trying to sort out how they should work together. And of course, in global health, the interface between health and security and the security sectors and foreign policy is becoming more and more important. So you see there's also, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, we're used to talking health and law policies about health and transport and health and nutrition or whatever. But you know, this stuff is going on every day. And we do have to be aware and involved in that as well. And of course, this negotiation, this push for health and law policies can come in two ways. It can come from the top down, and many of us were first surprised, then quite thrilled that the German presidency of the G7 put health on the agenda to the extent it did. And it was a very interesting example that a head of state comes to the World Health Assembly of the WHO, where usually only in quotes health ministers meet, to address them. So again, here you see, you know, health is moving up the political totem pole, and it's coming bottom up. And this, I think, is really also important when we talk about health literacy. This is from California. Our community's health matters. Let's fight for it. We have to come together. And you might know there were two referendums in California, one in Berkeley and one in San Francisco, on the soda tax. The one in Berkeley was successful. The one in San Francisco was not. The reason actually was because the cutoff level was higher. If I remember, in San Francisco, they needed a two-thirds majority. In Berkeley, I think it was 60% or something. So they were able to get it through. So, in terms of this health moving up the political totem pole, it's also interesting to say, you know, how do others see this? And this is the World Economic Forum defining the major risks societies face in the 21st century. They classified the risks along five dimensions, and it's very worthwhile looking at this report. It's issued every year. And actually, there's recently been a comparative study of all these reports. And if you say, okay, guys, you know, where is health? health is under societal risks. And you can see here for 2014 the main risks, the main global risks, and very obviously risk number one is the fiscal crisis, unemployment. And you can see already something of big concern to us if we're doing health policies. Number four, severe income disparity. So again, one of the things I believe if we're doing health and more policies is to be aware of studies like this, where health actually gets on the agenda, not through health people, but from other people who push political agendas, and to see how one can use that work. Because, it's for some people it makes a difference if you say the World Economic Forum has said that, than if you say the World Health Organization has said that. And so, having that context is, I believe, quite important. And you can see societal risks here relate to social stability. So looking from the outside, a lack of health is seen as a danger to social stability, and one of the issues you are also focusing on in your health and policies organization appears here, dysfunctional cities, for example, and you can see the issues, another issue you are really dealing with, the rising burden of chronic disease. So the WEF also underlines the interconnectedness of risks. And that's also something I would recommend to people doing health and all policies. Show how your risks are interconnected. Make that clear also to political decision makers. These are some examples of how such an interconnectedness and also a systems approach to the issues can be done. On the right, you have the obesity and showing clearly all the various action areas you need, food production, consumption, activity, environment, and all those things. And on the left, as I mentioned to you, and you'll get all these PowerPoints if you want them, you can see from an infectious disease, from an outbreak area, all the issues around health and law policies that you need, from law and order to telecom to food to health to defense and all the others. And again, I say we mustn't only look at this side, the right hand side that we are much more familiar with. Increasingly, we have to look at the left hand side, and we need to get our infectious disease colleagues on board for health and law policies. And of course, what's also quite important is to be able to show how, if you do not invest in health, and quite a lot of that has been done also through the WHO and various centers, is to show how you actually create a vicious economic cycle if you do not invest appropriately in disease control. And you see sort of the economics of and the various dimensions here. So I already said growing inequality is seen as a political risk by the World Economic Forum, and you can clearly see that all around the world. And that relates actually in a very interesting way to public health history and public health analyses. Some of you might be aware of George Rosen's work, and he says there have always been two strands of public health, the political and the technical strand, the technical scientific strand. And he says, depending on what point in time you are and what the context, either the one or the other is dominating, stronger. And I have suggested, in the 19th century, public health's focus was national, social, and political. Public health was very political in the 19th century. In the course of the 20th century, it stayed national. It became very medical. The professionalization is part of that. and it became increasingly technical. We had more mechanisms and ways of doing things. They didn't have all that stuff in the 19th century there. We had politics, basically, to deal with health. In the late 20th century, it moves to being more global, very economic, but still very technical. And actually, the economic and the technical come together. And you know, you get all these sensors from the World Bank, the science of delivery, and all those kind of things, and you're supposed to measure everything. And at present, partly pushed through the economic crisis, what we are getting is a focus that's increasingly global, increasingly social, in terms of social justice, and increasingly political. And you know, we're discussing things in health that, you know, we wouldn't have dreamt of that we would be discussing them today. Health and health policies in the US-EU transatlantic trade and investment partnership. I mean, that's a health and health policies issue. Or what you have here is tax levels that countries have as their tax income from companies, which are getting lower because, you know, they are moving to where they don't spend much money. So what's becoming very important as a skill for somebody active in health and health policies is what we call framing. And there's a big literature and on framing, literally, you know, how do you bring your issue across? And our own health frame might not always be the appropriate frame that we will need to use. We've therefore also been working on a couple of other frames. Oops, sorry, I moved too quickly. You're familiar with this frame. I don't want to say much on it. It's the social determinants frame. It's become very important over the last 10 years. It's also been slightly revised by Catalonia to also make it more appropriate for your environment. But the important thing was that in the social determinants, something that's often not highlighted, it says, you know, this thing on the right is shaped by the distribution of money, power, and resources, locally, nationally, and globally. A number of countries, like Catalonia as well, has therefore tried to move in direction of a determinants-based policy. I've just taken two examples where also it's in the law, and this is important. How do we get health policies in the law? Because, you know, then, and that's why we need intersectoral work a heck of a lot with lawyers in global health and health policies. Two examples here is, you know, the Public Health Act in Norway, and you can see here one of the principles is health and health policies, and the other is in South Australia that was adopted in 2013, I think. And here, of course, is your own approach, putting health and health policies very much in the center of the strategic approach. So in terms of the determinants framing, we've actually widened the notion of determinants. You're very familiar with the social determinants, the behavioral and cultural, and the environmental determinants, and of course the economic determinants, which interface with the social. We've added two, the political determinants of health and the commercial determinants of health. We feel that in a global consumer society, you need to look much more at the commercial determinants of health. We've tried to define the political determinants of health, the power constellations, and ideological positions that impact on health. And that second point seems to us to be very important for discussions. And then, you know, one of the things we're experiencing is that the future of health is sometimes decided in boardrooms rather than in ministries of health. The ideological positions are very important, and I just love this cartoon. I show it everywhere. And then there was a change of government and climate change just went away. This is an ideological determinant of health, because risk definition is about power. And any of you who were involved in the climate discussions know this, you know, whether you accept what the scientists say or not. And this is so important for us in healthcare policies because we try to base it on evidence. I mean, we do go in there and say, you know, guys, here's the evidence. You know, this is what climate change does to health. This is what tobacco does to health. This is what sugar does to health. But risk is, it's a power game. And we have to get more familiar with that power game to get away from the fairy tales. So there are competing values. WHO says health is a social goal of government. We have public health values, of course. And there's quite a big discussion right now, also in political philosophy, about, you know, what in the 21st century as a society do we collectively strive to pursue? Is health part of that what we want to reach collectively? Because there's a tremendous push to make health just something private, with each one, you know, not only in financing, but also in terms of responsibility. So the first big area where there is such big competition, the competing values, is around what Piketty calls the social state. And how do we define the social state? And we can see that all these three, the three key things that help define the social state, economic growth, social safety nets, and labor market policies are absolutely critical. And we see now in health promotion, if we're involved in health and all policies, suddenly, you know, we're talking about redistributive taxation. We are entering new areas of expertise that are absolutely critical for, and we need to be able to talk about it. You know, what will a progressive tax do? You know, it's those kind of things, and I'll show you a tax example in a minute. There's obviously competing values in macroeconomic policies, and we'll talk about that right now in terms of the European debate. But you know, this seriously impacts on what we are trying to do. Quite interesting, again, if one says, who else is arguing? A voice that is very respected is the OECD. And the OECD has actually come out quite clearly that one of the most important areas of action for health is fiscal policy. And therefore, again, if you are active in health and all policies, I would urge you to look at the arguments from the colleagues of the OECD. And you see they relate it in particular to the consumption of foods high in fat, sugar, and salt. And again, you know, this takes you into legislation. And you can see that calculations have been done for the United States. The calculation was that a tax on sugary drinks could save $17 billion for Bada. And here are some calculations for the United Kingdom and some for Australia. So, you know, the calculations are there, but, you know, politics isn't necessarily rational. And, you know, so you have the epidemiological evidence, you have the economic evidence, and still it's not enough. You need more, and that's where you usually need politicians and you need people. And, you know, what's really, really interesting, some of the arguments we've put forward about taxes, that, you know, general taxes can be unjust towards the people with lower income and things like that. This is the soft drinks industry saying, vote no to the beverage tax because it is unfair and it will hit the poor and the working people the hardest. So now the industry is teaching us social justice. But of course also they know the figures that we have produced, that the people who drink this stuff the most are exactly the poor and the low income working people. So they are losing a major part of their customer base if these products get to be more expensive. But this is the area that we need to be able to negotiate in. That's why we've spoken about the commercial determinants of health. Promoting consumption at the expense of health is, and it's related to toxic products, toxic environments, and toxic marketing in particular. Some people call it industrial epidemics because it's so related. And you can see here again the competing values around consumer freedom, the kind of arguments that are put forward. And you can see here, I really love this one, don't let bureaucrats tell you what size beverage to buy. But, you know, it's totally appropriate for marketing to tell you what size beverage you should be buying. So it gets quite heated. That's what we call wicked problems, that, you know, you need to, in a new way, address complexity, and that very much of the solution and who you can get on board depends on how the problem is framed. And we have developed a training manual for the WHO, which tries to spend quite a lot of time showing how you identify wicked problems, how you frame them, and how you try to take them into the international arena. And it reflects exactly what you've started to do here, a really qualitative transformation of public policies. You govern differently. It's all about governance. And these are the things you need to take forward. And so, of course, you know, the complex model you get on the left, you know, how does obesity work? You have to translate into a complex policy model on the right, which shows you all the areas where you need to act. And then from that, you need to start framing the issue and selecting sort of where you best act to be able to get the largest dynamic in the system. And that's the big difference that now happens. You're not just looking at the problem you're going to solve and its outcome. You're looking in health and all policies how you get the largest dynamic of change into the system. You can look at it, you know, like playing billiards, you push the ball and does this. So it moves rather far away. You can still do a vertical program. Yeah, but that's not the issue. You don't need to do everything, you know, because you can't do everything. And that's been part of the problem in health promotion, that, you know, people are so afraid of doing just one thing. Yes, you know, select the thing, but select the thing that creates the dynamics in the system. And that needs a fair bit of thinking, how you you get things together. So obviously I looked at PINSAP, just to prove I've read it. And you know, you have a fair bit of those elements there that, you know, can be taken forward. And this is important, that again, you know, you're looking at dynamics of the system and you're looking at collective impact. And collective impact means a commitment of a group of important actors from different sectors to a common agenda to solving a specific social problem. And you do that in a number of ways. And we were just discussing also about what is happening here in Girona around the work with health and crises, that, you know, if you build up continuous communication, you can fall back on that communication, on those relationships, when you need them for another issue. And so you need to frame the overall goal, you need to analyze its impact, and you clearly need to identify the value gained. That's the training manual that we developed. It's also available online, and you can study some of those things there. And I'll just jump over these. This one is really important. I said, yes, you know, you need to be aware of conflict, but one of the things you need to be able to do is to push your negotiation towards mutual gain. And one of the really, really interesting things that have developed in the health discussion, health and all policies discussion over the last couple of years, particularly in environment and health, is the notion of co-benefits. And I would urge you to look at those very carefully. This is clearly a co-benefit. You know, you get people to cycle, and at the same time, you know, they'll probably be a bit healthier when they do. And there's calculations now for promoting co-benefits that are really very interesting and allow you to take collective interest further. So that's what we're basically doing in trying to think health promotion further, the process of enabling people to increase control over and to improve their health. It's gotten significantly more complex, it's gotten more global. There's an inequality in power and resources. This is the Berkeley example. The power and resources were basically 10 to 1. This is what happened from the side of the industry. They bought up literally every advertising space in the city. Just imagine that, to argue against that proposition. And that's what the community activists did, you know, from house to house, etc. The ones on the right won. But this is, you know, our community, our health, we've got to be able to do it. So my last message is, when we go into the political realm, we of course, we have these three big areas. We have the economics, we have the whole issue of the social state, and we have sustainable development with the aspect of sustainable production and consumption. But what's really, really, really the political challenge for us is that we have to work towards ensuring that our democratic institutions value health. And that means the parliaments, and that means the citizens. And therefore, our discussion around health literacy must have a very political dimension. I'm told a research group now wants to do a study on the health literacy of the parliamentarians in the European Parliament. I think that'd be very interesting. So we must invest in the health literacy of the parliamentarians and of the citizens who elect them. That is absolutely critical, because more and more of the decisions about our health are not going to be technical decisions, but are going to be decisions taken in the political arena. And therefore, the slogan that we are using a lot right now is, you know, people say health is a personal choice and all of that, that we clearly say that health is a political choice. Health is a political choice at all levels of government. Thank you very much.